name is Jacob Moses, community builder at Strongtowns, and welcome to It's the Little Things, a Strongtowns podcast where in each episode, we focus on a different action that you, the concerned citizen, the elected official, the city planner, can take to make your town stronger. This episode's action? Getting ideas for making your neighborhood stronger. And to help us unpack this action, we've got Strongtowns president and founder Charles, aka Chuck Marone, on the podcast to share his wisdom and personal experiences from getting ideas to make his own neighborhood in Brainerd, Minnesota, stronger. Before we dive into the interview, I want everyone, whether you're a concerned citizen or a public official, to take a moment to think about the last time you took a walk through your neighborhood. What did you notice? Likely you noticed some good, such as budding flowers or friends hanging out outside a local theater. On the contrary, you likely also noticed the struggles others face navigating daily life in your neighborhood. A gentleman still standing at the bus stop after you've had coffee with a friend. A woman walking through tall grass to get to the grocery. Or a senior citizen understandably hesitant to cross the road as the crosswalk signal begins its countdown. It's in these moments where we have two options. A, make a mental note and maybe use it as an anecdote at a future city council meeting. Or B, humble ourselves, put ourselves in their shoes, and together generate an idea that takes the next incremental step in filling these voids in our cities, towns, and neighborhoods. In this episode, we'll discuss how you can, from a place of humility, get ideas that can make your neighborhood stronger, including how both the concerned citizen and the public official can act on ideas, how to share those ideas with your tribe, and most important, how to take the next incremental step in making your neighborhood stronger. Enjoy.
Jacob, doing fantastic. So nice to talk to you.
Yes, likewise. How's life in Brainerd?
You know what? We got back from our staff retreat where we were in Florida, and quite a different climate here. It's in the teens, and we got snow on the ground. But the ice skating rink looks like it's days away from being ready. We've got an ice skating rink like a block and a half from my house. And, you know, Christmas is in the air. I started baking cookies yesterday with the kids, and you know, it's all good. Yeah. Life is beautiful.
I'm happy to hear it, Chuck. So Chuck, we got a great action to discuss together today, and that is getting ideas for making your neighborhood stronger. And I'm particularly excited about this action for a couple of reasons. First, it's going to be some great action items for the strong citizens. And for listeners, if you're unfamiliar with this term, these are the folk who understand the Strongtowns message, see how it can make their own cities, towns, and neighborhoods stronger, and are going out and doing the little things to make their neighborhoods stronger. So we're going to be able to get some great action items for those folk. And then secondly, Chuck, we get to talk about your neighborhood's first report, the report that you did in 2014. We partnered with a couple other Brainerd nonprofits to try out some small bets to make Brainerd stronger. And there's some really great insights that listeners will be able to pull from that as well. So it's going to be a good chat.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was so much fun, you know, and I think anytime you do something in your own town, it's got you know, a lot of passion involved in it. So let's go for it.
Yeah, very good. So Chuck, I want to start off by talking about how we generate ideas to make our town stronger. You know, like I've found myself doing this too, where I'll wait for like a success story of someone else in a different town to be inspired to take action in my own neighborhood. Or I'll wait for some kind of viral placemaking tweet of hay bales along a bike lane, and I'll see how I can do that in my own neighborhood. And you know, it's fine to wait to be inspired by others to take action, but there's an even better way to get ideas that are specific to your neighborhood. And that's by, as you talk about in this report, going outside and experiencing your neighborhood on foot. Chuck, can you tell us why this method is so important and how it helped you get ideas for strengthening Brainerd?
I think it's even more important for professionals, right? I think it's important for everybody. For me, I had this, I'm not going to try to make it sound harder than it was, but I think this like difficult intellectual path, because as an engineer, as a planner, you think you know the answer to everything, right? I mean, that's, you're trained, you're told, you know, here's how you handle this situation and that situation. What we did, and I think this was something that evolved and became kind of a radical insight that now is kind of core to the Strong Towns approach, is we went out and actually tried to just observe without any kind of preordained filter of what should be or what should become, just tried to observe where people were struggling in this neighborhood. And we took extra steps to, I mean, literally and figuratively, but literally we took extra steps to go out and walk with people, just like be out there in the neighborhood, existing alongside of the people who live in the neighborhood and just talk to them. You know, often as professionals, we'll ask people like, what do you think the best, the biggest challenge is, or what do you think the biggest opportunity is? And people think like in the abstract. But when you walk with them, when you're actually there, like with them, you get a sense really quick of, you know, even things that they're not putting into words necessarily, like if you gave them a survey or something, but their actual experiences on the ground. And we try to use those experiences as the basis for what, you know, what actions we should take and what insights we had. It's in a sense like a complete inversion of the top-down planning process. And even the planning process where we, you know, we really try to do our public engagement. We try to get out there and be the public, you know, like very consciously, like be part of this neighborhood.
Yeah, it makes me think of this Ryan Holiday quote that goes, right action follows the right perspective. So I imagine if someone started walking around their neighborhood and their perspective was, okay, what observations can I make that I can translate into the next mobile app or translate into the next technology discovery? What is the right perspective, Chuck, to be able to really make strong observations that can make our town stronger? You talk about humbling yourself. Could you elaborate more on that?
Yeah. That's the old adage, you know, walk a mile in someone else's shoes. And you know, we throw that out. And I think particularly in the city building business, you know, the idea is to listen to people. And I think it actually goes beyond that. I think there is a humbling that must accompany this, where not only do you like literally walk a mile in their shoes, get out and experience the place as people experience it, but that you also kind of do away with your own preconceived notions. I wrote this piece a couple years ago about the cargo cult of planning. And in the 1940s, as we were fighting in World War II, in the South Pacific, the American fighting troops would show up on an island, islands that had very little contact with Western civilization. And they would come in and they would build these huge runways, all this like, you know, towers, control towers for landing aircraft. They would build warehouses. They would fly in and unload supplies and use these places kind of jumping off points. And the natives who lived on these islands obviously had never experienced anything like this. Of course, as the war progressed, you would be on an island for a short period of time and then move on. And on the next island, you'd do the same thing, but you would abandon the one you were just on. And the natives, you know, having experienced chocolate and cigarettes and, you know, all these goodies that came along with these big, huge things landing from the sky, would go out and try to recreate the conditions that they had experienced as success. So there's all these anthropologists went decades later and looked at this. There were all these people out there, and they would sit around the old conference room table, like pretending they were having a conference. They would stand out on the runway and wave their hands in the air, like that would summon an airplane. It's not that these people were not smart. It's not that these people lacked intelligence. It's that they didn't fully grasp all of the intricacies that went with bringing a plane full of chocolate and other things to that island.
Yeah.
I think as planners, what we do is we look at success. We go to the next city and we say, wow, that's a really successful street. Or we look over and like, well, that's a really successful convention center or stadium or bridge project or whatever it is. And we interpose that on our place without understanding two things. One, all the intricacies that make it successful there. And two, all of the needs and the difficulties and other things that are going on in our own community. I think if we free ourselves from the former, that free ourselves in a humble way to think that we know the answer and realize that we're just like a cargo cult too, like we're just trying to impose other people's ideas on our places. If we can humble ourselves and free ourselves from that, and then turn around and actually walk a mile in people's shoes and try to understand the world as they do, I think that frees us up to ask way better questions about, what types of investments make good public investments? What types of actions are really needed to move this thing in a better direction?
Love it. So Chuck, what do we do with these ideas? We're humbling ourselves, walking our neighborhoods, and we notice a mother having to walk through the tall grass to get to the grocery. So we have an idea for some kind of stronger surface, like a sidewalk or gravel, or we see cars speeding through our neighborhood and have the idea of a traffic calming project. I'd love to hear your perspective of what both the strong citizen can do with these ideas and the planner. Like for the strong citizen, does he or she just need to go out and do what they can the next day? Or do you recommend gathering a tribe beforehand and getting some more resources to make these ideas happen? What are your thoughts?
That's a really good question, because I do think that it's a little bit different from a professional standpoint than a citizen standpoint. Mm-hmm. I always tell professionals, I think what we have to discipline ourselves to do is to ask the question, what's the next smallest thing I can do right now to make this better? I think often we want to come in with the grand solution. Like in my hometown, people are having difficulty walking. So let's put sidewalks on every street and, really, you talk about the amount of money, the amount of pushback, the amount, just the effort. Let's put bike lanes everywhere. It feels like progress. It feels like we're making, things better. But the reality is that's not what's needed in a lot of places. And in some places you need something else. So I think looking at individual sites and asking, like, what's the next smallest thing we could do right now to make this a little bit better? That actually translates really well into citizens who want to take action. If you're a strong citizen, how do you make this better? Well, really, you make it better with a lot of little small steps.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea of forming a tribe of people, of having a group of people that are passionate about a place, and using that kind of collective action as your, not only as your motivation and as your feedback, but also as kind of like your protection from, ramifications, right? Yeah. Being a lone wolf is a hard thing to do. Being with a group of people is going to keep you honest and keep you safe. I think getting out there and doing things to kind of nudge your community in a different direction is a really healthy way to go. Small little things. We went out and, in the middle of the night, we're putting in crosswalks in places where, we had kind of identified through walking with people, they needed them, doing things to create some edge friction on some streets in a temporary way, documenting that, using that as feedback for the city to like, here, you should do this permanently. I think those are really good things for citizens to do, to kind of raise awareness and to solve, real problems in a neighborhood.
Yeah. And Chuck, I appreciate you talking about the value of, doing something first and making small bets. It was the coolest thing. I came home from our staff retreat, which you mentioned in the intro, to find about 20 people in my parents' home discussing how to beautify the two entrances into their neighborhood. I had no idea this was being orchestrated.
Wow.
Yeah. I hadn't seen many of these people before. And it was a random idea that my mother had. She noticed that the two entrances were looking pretty barren, and she wanted just to, you know, plant some flowers and put up a couple other items to beautify those entrances, and was able to gather all these neighbors. And she and I had talked, of course, before about just the value of small bets, sharing the wisdom that I've acquired from working at Strongtowns with her. But she noticed that as she was trying to articulate the value of small bets and just doing the next incremental step, that her neighbors were talking, you know, like you said, we need to go big, and to the tune of $40,000. Right. It said, no, we need to put in a sprinkler system so we don't have to walk there every couple of days to water.
Right.
For the leader in the neighborhood who's humbled themselves, had an idea, understands the value of the next incremental step in a series of small bets, yet they're getting this pushback from their neighbors who want to go big. How can this neighborhood leader cast the vision and kind of get a shared language with their neighbors to really encourage the benefit of the incremental step and the small bets throughout the neighborhood?
I've come to recognize this as the kind of the challenge that we've faced in, you know, the post-war development pattern. We've had all of access to all these resources. We've had the ability to essentially, you know, go big in almost every way. And we've kind of come to expect that. There's kind of two insights that I've had. The first that changes my view on that. The first one is that we are broke. I mean, like literally as a society, when you look at our great affluence, it is not an affluence of families, of small businesses. You know, we all have seen the reports about, you know, people would have trouble paying for a car, a car repair. Most retirees have less than $10,000 saved. I mean, these are cataclysmic tragedies of impoverishment that a society shouldn't be as wealthy as ours should not be facing. So I always like try to humble myself and say, if we recognized how poor we were, if that was like a living reality that decision makers shared with people who were poor and did have to live that, what kind of decisions would we make that are different? I think a lot of times people, especially people in city building business, especially technical professionals, you know, tend to not be among those kind of most impoverished. And so you assume a certain level of affluence, whether it's, you know, we can increase taxes over here, we can raise fees over here, or, you know, we'll borrow the money and make it up later. I'm like deeply respectful of the fact that this is painful for people. And so, you know, if you were poor, what would you do? And the answer is, if you were poor, you would do with what you had. So I'm always of the mindset of, let's go out and try something with what we have. And let's see what happens. If we go out and we fix up the entrance of the park and, you know, no one cares about it enough to actually go out and water those plants, then, you know, thank goodness we didn't spend $40,000 putting in a plant watering system, because nobody really gives a damn, you know? But if people go out and water it and care for it and are passionate about it, then maybe over time it would make sense to put in that watering system. I mean, maybe we would get to the point where we had enough plants, we had enough things going on. It created enough like value for our lives and our community where it would make sense to put that in, and not just put it in, but then maintain it over time. You know, you got to go out. Well, here I'm thinking like a Minnesotan. You got to go out in the fall and get the air out so it doesn't freeze up in the winter. You don't have that problem in Texas, but but you do have to maintain it, and you do have to, you know, go out and take care of it. Is that, you know, are you going to develop the love and passion for this place to the extent that can be justified? You know, when we're working at the neighborhood level as people, there's a financial aspect to this, but there's also just a human energy aspect to this. And a lot of what your mom's doing, which is really the hard work that needs to happen, is beautiful. is building this mm-hmm. human capital, this human energy to care about a place. And that's almost like putting resources in a bank account. You know, it's like a savings account. Yeah. You're building that up. And a project like, you know, beautifying the entrance to the park is one of those things that if you just jump to the end condition, it's like, yeah, I threw my $50 into the pot and we got it done. If you're actually out there watering plants and meeting your neighbors and caring for a place mutually together and like, hey, I'm going to be on vacation for a week. Can you take my spot and do this? You're building something stronger than that. You're building something deeper than just, you know, now we got pretty plants.
Yes. I appreciate talking about human capital because it was the coolest thing. I had just gotten home. I was in the other room eating some leftover chicken enchiladas, and I was hearing people say, hey, I'm so-and-so, I'm so-and-so, so nice to meet you. People talking about their professions and how they envision the neighborhood. And I'd admittedly been like a little critical at first of just a purely suburban right. neighborhood before I joined Strong Towns, because like I envisioned neighborhoods, like if it's a good neighborhood, it has to be mixed use. That's the only way you can meet people. That's the only way you get vision. But I was proved wrong Sunday afternoon as these people came together. And yeah, it's not talking about like a pop-up coffee right. shop. It's just simple as planting flowers. But regardless, I mean, there were these beautiful connections happening and everyone walked there. There was not That's a fantastic. Single car outside of our residence. And they're walking out in pairs and talking. It was
I think that what you probably recognize, and I'll let you off the hook a little bit, is that it's harder in suburban areas, right? Like in a good walkable neighborhood, there's kind of a natural energy that's created by that human friction every day. You know, the fact that you run into people and, you know, you see and experience humans around you in a different way. In suburban areas, it has to be very intentional, right? Like you have to want it and you have to seek it out. More and more places are. And I think we can applaud them. It's just it's a layout that makes it a bigger challenge, right?
Yeah.
So that's awesome. I want to meet your parents now.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. So Chuck, another really profound point that you made in the Neighborhoods First reports was the calculated public return on investment, and just thinking about how little. We need in public costs to maintain these small bets. I can imagine this being a great way for, say, a neighborhood association who adopts this small bet, next incremental step philosophy, to go to the city and say, hey, this is a much more appropriate, fiscally smart way to improve our neighborhoods. How can these neighborhood leaders calculate public return on investment for their projects?
That's another good question. Let me frame it like this. I started that Neighborhoods First project in the context of my city doing a $7+ million project that ultimately wound up to be $13.5 million. So it, just a huge, huge project. And everyone was convinced, and I say everyone in air quotes, everyone at City Hall was convinced that this was a great project, that this would be create all kinds of benefits and all kinds of tax base and growth and all the good things that come with capital spending. And so I went out and part of the projects that we recommended, you know, the total cost was $16,700. So like very little, right? And I did this calculation in the report where I said, okay, no one at City Hall ever calculated like, what's it going to take to make this big, huge project, this $7 million plus project pay off? Here's what that would mean in terms of our tax base. Our tax base would need to go up. And I can't remember what it was. It was like $64 million. It was some huge, huge number. And then I turned around and said, okay, if we're going to spend this $16,700, here's how much our tax base would need to go up in order to justify that. You know, in order to have that be like essentially cash flow break even. And it was mm-hmm. not an insignificant amount because I said, let's the one I amortized over like a lifetime or a generation, I'm sorry, like 30 years. And the other one I amortized over five. I said, you know, let's make these little improvements, like have quick paybacks, but it was tiny. It was like a tiny amount of yeah. money. And my point in that was not that you know, we should have like real, real rigor about the return on investment of painting that sidewalk or painting that crosswalk or fixing that little stretch of sidewalk. But what we should do instead is recognize that we don't have any rigor when we're spending $7 million. You know, like we're not doing any return on investment calculation at all. If we're going to not have any rigor at all, let's have no rigor on like small little things with quick payback windows. So we can at least like, if we fail, we fail within the constraints of something we can afford. Or if we fail, we can learn from that failure at a small scale, as opposed to have our failures be big and only revealed, you know, years and years later, when we have to go out and fix something that we never should have built in the first place. So I've talked about this as like the difference between a Singapore and an Italian approach. The Singapore approach, and I say this respectfully, the Singapore approach being a very like spreadsheet-minded approach. Like, let's go out and calculate everything and figure out what's going on. And I think that's an approach that is acceptable. I mean, I think if you want to have that level of rigor to track, you know, every block and every neighborhood and put it all in spreadsheets and figure it out and back test your stuff and then do projections and then every year update your data based on or update your projections based on the new data coming in. I think there's a level of rigor there that you can have from a spreadsheet standpoint that will reveal a lot of insight. I think an Italian approach is kind of the opposite, which is to say, you know, this worked 1,000 years ago. Well, what do you know? Like, let's just go out and do the same thing. you know, and I've spent a fair amount of time in Italy. That's really like the analysis that goes on a lot of times. Like, you know, this is how we do it. You know, have a pizza. Like, let's go do this. And, you know, there's something I think beautiful about that because you are, in a sense, you know, not fooling yourselves with math, but actually just, you know, tying into something that has been shown to work and work over a long, long period of time.
Cool. And what gets me most excited about that, Chuck, is, you know, the strong citizen is very good at articulating like, you know, the anecdotes of these small bets, you know, like they'll talk about how all the neighbors came together for a big lunch that they threw, like very good storytellers. But to be able to, you know, get that shared language with our city officials, you know, it often demands more than anecdotes. So even if we don't adopt too much rigor, to at least be able to have that shared language of maintenance, return on investment, tax base, I imagine would be huge for these neighborhood leaders who want to encourage our cities to adopt more incremental steps in bettering their neighborhoods.
I think that public officials largely, and this is painting with a broad brush, but I feel like it's largely true. I think they come into office, you know, at least at the very beginning, with the language of the public, right? Like with the experience of the public, the stories, the anecdotes, that kind of thing. And a lot of times what you see is that like the professionals, the if we want to use a derogatory term and call them the bureaucracy, or if we want to like step back and say like, you know, the credentialed people who are working within the system, they have their own language and their own priorities. And they kind of sometimes, and I was part of this. I mean, I did this when I worked for cities. You sit down and you fill that person in on like, here's what's what. You know, like here are the constraints, the real world we have to work with. And I almost feel like that is it's a disservice. Because yes, there are real world things we have to do. We have to put together budgets. We have to follow certain procedures and processes that are mandated by the state and the federal government. But a lot of things like project selection is something that you know, I think public officials would do a lot differently if they led it instead of if it came from, in a sense, the people who are already in the system. I think that there is much more passion. And certainly when I go around and talk about the Neighborhoods First report and some of those insights, public officials have a lot of passion for this approach. The idea of going out and humbling yourself to walk the neighborhood and to try to understand, you know, the hardship, and then to ask those questions, you know, what are the things we can do right now to make this better? I think public officials largely at the local level get that and want that and crave that. It's kind of the imposition of, you know, well, here's the big project that we have to do, or here's the, you know, here's the big thing that we've been working on for 6 years and now, you know, has come to fruition, and we've got the grant from this place, and we've got the support from these legislators, and we've got like the Chamber of Commerce on board. And now, you know, you would like to go out and fix the sidewalks and plant some street trees and make the neighborhood nice, but you're being told you got to spend $7 million to run sewer and water pipe out to a cornfield in the middle of nowhere. It's hard to stop that, you know. It's hard to be the one to like step in front of that train. And I do feel like our, if there's a takeaway for public officials, it's that I think we need to be, I don't want to say like bolder and braver. It's not like an in the face kind of thing, but I think more confident about what we know from being in the neighborhoods are the issues that people are dealing with. And I think a little more resistant to the kind of comfortable, formulaic approach that our current system likes to give us.
Beautiful. And this reminds me of, I think it might have been the second episode of It's Little Things. We had Glenn Ferris on the episode to talk about how listeners can start a neighborhood association. And his big takeaway, and the reason we should start neighborhood associations, is that it gives public officials a point of contact, you know, in regards to any kind of issues or new projects. So say we're talking about new sidewalks, the public officials humbled his or herself and understands we need to get some sidewalks down here. Because our neighbors have already been banding together and have that vision, it probably makes it a lot more easier for there to be, you know, that mutual benefit proposition between the two groups.
I think a lot of times public officials and staff in particular look at neighborhood groups as a big, you know, pain in the neck, right? They're the ones complaining. They're the ones demanding this, demanding that. I think Jane Jacobs, you know, said it right. You know, our cities are need to be co-created. You know, they'll have a place for everybody when everybody has a place in making them. And, you know, I think my critique of the public in general is that we're too often, especially on the affluent end of the spectrum, we're too often willing to just pay our taxes and then expect government to perform, you know, as if it's like a McDonald's drive-through. You know, like I pull in, I give you my money, give me my cheeseburger, I pay my taxes, fix my street, pay my road, keep my park nice. Cities are co-creations. I mean, they really, really are. And I think that when we let ourselves off the hook as citizens, we're gonna wind up in something that is subpar. And I think when we as professionals or as public leaders don't involve citizens or involve citizens in like superficial ways that are comfortable for us, I think we also are gonna have lesser places. I think the places that really are exciting today are the ones where there is a little bit of like tension and friction between people on the ground and people at City Hall. And it's not necessarily like combative and mean, but there is like an ongoing, anything you undertake, I mean, a marriage, a business partnership, you know, there are times when like it works really well. And then there's times of conflict and friction. And the strength of it is how you deal with that conflict and friction. And I think in cities, we often tend to kind of channelize it or relegate it to the side or put it in some process that is safe and comfortable. And I think we actually need to embrace it.
Yeah. Love it, Chuck. Well, Chuck, to wrap up, and this is the question that we end every podcast with, how does generating these ideas with a humble perspective make our town stronger?
I think right now in 28, you know, to end 2018 and looking the next decade or two ahead, what we need more than ever in our cities is to start patching them back together. We have been on this huge experiment. And it is an experiment that has separated us physically, moved our houses further apart, moved where we shop, where we eat, where we live, all separated. It's made our park something we drive to instead of, you know, experience day after day. And it's separated ourselves from one another. Those little passive relationships that humans had experienced for thousands of years that made us who we are, made us capable of living together and doing complex, important things. We have kind of intentionally and unintentionally divided all that, spread that all apart, bifurcated it in ways that I think are unhelpful. And so our task over the next decade, two, three, however long it takes, is to stitch this stuff back together, to stitch back together physically our cities, to stitch back together culturally our relationships with each other. And so, I think this humble approach, this idea of going out and identifying where people struggle, and another way to say that is identifying the highest returning investments you can make in your community, by going out and doing that, we're going to be building strong towns. I mean, that's how we are going to make our cities financially strong and resilient again.
Wonderful. Well, Chuck, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us and joining us on the It's the Little Things podcast. By the off chance that this is the first time that someone's finding out about strong towns, they can find strong towns on Twitter and Facebook. If someone wants to connect with you personally online, where can people find you?
It's really fun because I have a bunch of different ways. I'm on Facebook and I try to get back to people when they message me. I think the best way is probably on our Slack. I in terms of like prioritizing things, we have our own discussion board, our own Slack channel. And, I can't remember the URL on our website for that, but I spend most of my time on Slack. So that's probably the best place, but email works too, marone@strongtowns.org. And I'll do what I can to get back to you as quick as I can. Twitter works at CL Marone, right? So, and then you can just call too. I mean, you can actually call Strong Towns phone number, 844-218-1681. Ask for me and they will patch you through to me, which is pretty cool.
It is cool.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Chuck, thank you so much again. We will chat very soon.
Hey, thank you, Jacob. And I got to say, this podcast is a lot of fun. I enjoy listening to it every week. And I know, we're having hundreds of people now downloading this and it will soon be thousands every week.
Yes, sir.
It's a fun, I love the idea of, it literally is the little things that are going to make our cities great. So bravo to you and let's keep going.
Thank you very much. Cool. Well, thank you everyone. And we'll talk soon, Chuck.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. If you're enjoying the content, please subscribe to It's the Little Things on iTunes, and we will chat next week. See ya.